Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Taking care of a family member with a chronic condition can be an act of love, an act of duty, an act of necessity, or all three at once. No matter how you look at it, caregiving is hard work. It can be incredibly stressful and isolating. It can take a serious emotional and health toll on a caregiver. It also has economic consequences. According to a survey conducted by the AARP, there are 330,000 unpaid caregivers living in Iowa right now. As our population ages, that number will grow. This hour, we're going to focus on caregiving. Later in the hour, Alicia Frady of Connections Area Agency on Aging and Paige Yance of the AARP will be here to explore the challenges caregivers face, the resources that are available, the gaps in those resources, and what could be done to give caregivers the support they need for this essential work. But first, Elise Free is a member of what is often called the sandwich generation. She's the mother of a child who is under 18, but is also involved in giving care to an elderly parent. Free's sandwich is more complicated than most because her daughter was born with cystic fibrosis, and she is with me now. Hello, Elise.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
And first, I want to talk about your daughter. She's 17 years old now, and she was born with cystic fibrosis. And this is such a terrible disease that involves so much support and care. Give me a little bit of an idea of the journey that you and Addie have been on over the years.
So she was diagnosed at 4 months. She was considered failure to thrive. So she was like 8 pounds at 4 months, and nobody could figure out what was going on. And we were in Los Angeles, and that was before they did newborn screening. Now, I believe every state has it. So it just took a long time to figure out what was going on with her and why she was so sick. And it required, I think, almost like 3 weeks in the hospital with blood transfusions and getting her kind of baseline. And now she's doing great. I mean, she's 17. She does everything I don't like the word normal, but like all normal kids do. But it requires a tremendous amount of work on her part and respiratory therapy, and has a ton of specialists. It's her health has to come first with everything in life.
Well, and you moved back to Iowa in part because of the caregiving that you needed to do. You moved back to Iowa from California for support.
Yeah, almost my entire family is here, and I, had a great friend support system in Los Angeles, but I think when it comes to something like that, you need there are just certain things that you can ask your family to do that you don't normally ask friends. So that was big. And, I love Iowa and wanted to raise her here, too.
You are a mother. And, I mean, that's a caregiver already in and of itself. You're also a single mom. So you've been balancing work with being a mom and with the serious health needs as well.
Yeah.
That has to have been incredibly challenging over the years. I mean, tell me how you've been able to balance everything that you needed to do with working.
So I'm incredibly lucky in the fact that I work from home. I work for a television director as a personal assistant. And so when she was little, I would take her and my dog to work, and my boss was great, and he totally understood. And there are definitely days where I can't work, and if she is hospitalized or needs extra respiratory treatments, or something comes up, you can't work, and to have a boss that understands and is accepting of that is, I'm very, very, very lucky.
But well, over the last 17 years, I mean, there have been good periods where your daughter's been relatively healthy and doing well. And then there have been really, really tough periods, too. So you never really know exactly what you're facing.
Yeah. And even just dealing with health insurance companies and getting the right care, that is so time consuming. I mean, that maybe takes up more of my time than actually caring for her physically. And it's that has probably been one of the biggest struggles, is just managing care.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because I think that that's probably not something that most people who haven't lived this life think of, as, you know, they think about the actual hands-on care that you would need to give. But tell me about the struggles you've had with insurance over the years.
I mean, I could write a book. It would be very boring and nobody would want to read it. But it's like insurance companies don't want to pay for what you need. And so you have to go to bat. You have to just constantly struggle. And like, her medications are so expensive. Just one of her medications that she takes every day is over $300,000 a year. And that's just one. And so we would meet our deductible on January 1st. And then they would say, the insurance company would be like, well, does she still have cystic fibrosis? And I'm like, yes.
There is not a cure.
That is not going away. So yeah, she still requires all of these medications. And, you know, these are meds that she has a medication that's a pancreatic enzyme, and without it, she can't eat food. So it's not like, okay, she can miss a couple days or miss a dose. These are all life-saving medications. And so I have definitely been on the phone with agencies and saying to them, like, you know, this is life or death. You need to understand that. And it's hard to kind of make that connection sometimes.
Your daughter is 17 now. She's got another year left in high school, and you're preparing her to go out into the world. She will be much more responsible for her own care and hopefully living a very full, independent life. How do you prepare her not just to take care of herself, but to deal with insurance red tape, that kind of thing? How do you think about that?
I'm terrified. I mean, it's she's a really responsible kid. She's very good about taking her meds. And, you know, at 17, I'm not there all of the time. And she drives and she's out with friends and she'll come home late. And she takes her meds. Like, she definitely knows the routine. I still handle all of the phone calls and making appointments and that kind of stuff. And I think that transition's going to be tricky. I probably should have started doing that a little bit earlier. But you don't want, like, it's hard. I'm 45. It's hard for me to do all these things. So it's to then put it on a kid who already has enough going on. I think there's a balance between it's going to be a gentle transition. And I told her that if she's 40 and needs help with calling insurance companies and specialists and stuff, like, obviously, as long as I'm alive, I'm gonna help her.
Now let's talk about the other slice of that sandwich.
Yeah.
Your dad has Alzheimer's now, and I know that your mom is his primary caregiver, but you, as a supportive daughter, you're also involved in that. Tell me what that feels like right now.
Yeah, I mean, my mom does a terrific job, and she's super hands-on. And he does go to a care facility twice a week, which I think has been huge and has really helped her, because just the full-on constant care that he requires is huge, and she needed that. And my sister and I, we try to help out as often as we can, but we both have super busy lives and work, and I have my kiddo that I need to take care of. So I wish I could do more, but it's, you know, I'll make meals and stop. And I'm a terrible cook, so that's probably not the nicest contribution. But yeah, I think there's a sense of guilt, too, that comes with it because I wish I could do a lot more than I can.
Well, and for people in our generation, you probably don't just think about your dad, but also as your mom is getting older, is that something that weighs on your mind as well, making sure that she's okay and bearing up under the stress of being a caregiver?
Absolutely. And I don't know how much she's such a like Midwestern mom and doesn't want to complain about it. And I know she has so much on her plate. So, yeah, I worry for her and her whole family. I mean, it's a rotten disease, and it's so hard to watch, and extended family watching it happen. I mean, it's kind of a slow train wreck, and it's really, really sad.
For other people who find themselves becoming caregivers for whatever reason, do you have advice? You've been living this life for a long time.
So I do a few things to keep myself sane, and it's gotten a lot easier, too, as my daughter got older and is more self-sufficient. I go for a hike every day, and I get out in nature, and not just, like, walking around the neighborhood. I go out to the woods and walk with my dog, and that just is huge for my mental and physical health because you really do have to take care of yourself. If you don't, you're not going to be a good caregiver. You won't have anything to give. So I'm pretty strict with myself about that, except I do make an exception in Iowa because it's when it gets below zero, I'm like, yeah, no.
That kind of self-care doesn't feel like self-care.
No.
And you've also done, we only have about 30 seconds, but deal to connect with other people who have been living with cystic fibrosis, right?
Yeah, having a support group is huge, and reaching out to people and being honest. And I think that's so important for mental health as well.
Elise Free, thank you so much for talking with
me. Thank you.
Elise Free lives in Des Moines. In this hour, we're talking about the work of unpaid caregivers. Later on, Alicia Frady of Connections Area Agency on Aging and Paige Yance of the AARP will be here. We'd also love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about unpaid caregivers, the essential work they do, the costs of that work, the resources that are available for caregivers, and what more could be done to support them. We'll hear another personal story in just a few minutes. But with me now is Alicia Frady, a caregiver specialist with Connections Area Agency on Aging, although she is also a caregiver in her own life as well. Alicia, welcome.
Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you so much for being here. And tell me a little bit, for people who are not familiar with the work that you do at Connections Area Agency on Aging, tell me a little bit about the work that you do and what you provide.
For sure. So I am a caregiver specialist, and so my role is to talk with the caregivers initially to see what their needs are and what they're doing for their care recipients. So I'm finding out if they're in need of in-home health care, or respite care for them, and then just kind of listening to them to see what their role as a caregiver is, seeing how they're doing.
So I was just talking with Elise, and you know, she's in this position of being a member of this so-called sandwich generation. She is caring for a child. She also has elderly parents. That's not necessarily a typical scenario. Tell me a little bit about the caregiving population that you work with.
Yes, we actually do work with a lot of caregivers that are in that sandwich generation. It's kind of the area that is more, or coming more,
more about, common. Yeah.
More common. So, we also work with the 60 and older population. A lot of husbands and wives that are caring for their spouse, and then also with the sons and daughters that are also caring for their parents.
We were just talking about, Elise was mentioning that her mom is somebody who feels like she can handle it all, she can take care of things. What actually leads people to call you? Because I suspect a lot of people are like, I'm fine, I can do this, until suddenly they're not.
Right. A lot of times they're calling in with caring for someone with dementia. At various stages of the disease, they're mostly at their wit's end, caring for them, and just are looking for resources or someone to listen to or to them, or need help applying for assistance, or just getting resources to them.
Alicia, I want you to stay with us, but I want to talk to another person about their personal story. Jan Blevins lives in Cedar Falls, and she's been caring for her husband for a number of years. He's suffering from dementia and has needed increasing care for the last 7 years at least. Hello, Jan.
Good morning. Thanks for chatting with me.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for being here. And Jan, tell me a little bit about what you've been experiencing. Your husband started showing signs of memory loss about 10 years ago, right?
Correct.
So how did things progress?
And then it all really came to a head in 2016 when we were on a group trip to Italy. And he got lost from the group for a few hours.
Oh, wow.
So that's when things truly came to a head, probably when I first admitted it. I mean, I knew things were happening, but probably the first time that I admitted it to friends and extended family, because there was no doubt that something was happening with him.
As he needed more and more help, where did you turn for advice on how to manage that?
Well, my daughter had become quite involved in the Alzheimer's Association where she lives, and so I would garner information from that. You just kind of wing it every day. We turned to some doctors, but it's a progressive disease and there's no cure, so. And you can try a few meds that kind of stall things, but for the most part, it just is progressive no matter what you try to do. And so you just kind of wing it day by day and constantly on guard for things that are changing and strange behaviors that take place. But so you kind of just do it on your own. I joined two support groups, which have a wealth of information from the other individuals that are experiencing the same type of situations. And that's pretty much where I got my information. I would read things, different books, but it was just kind of trial by error.
As things progressed, of course, and have continued to progress, I mean, caregiving got a lot more intense. And you found that he wanted to be with you all the time. Tell me about that.
That is correct. They say caregiving's 24/7. I say with my husband, it was 24/7/3 because for many months, and probably years, he just wanted to be about 3 feet away from me. So I would get up and he would follow me, and or I'd go into the bathroom and pretty soon there he'd appear. He just needed to be near me. People would say, well, you're his comfort. And it's like, I understand that. I get that. But, you know, there gets to be a point when it's just
right.
A little bit overwhelming.
Right. Even though it's entirely understandable that he was feeling frightened and stressed right. and wanted to be with you because he trusted and loved you so much. The toll that that took on you must have been enormous.
It was, because, I mean, there was never really any breathing point, you know. I mean, he just was there, and he never, he was not a person that you could put down and sit in front of a television set and have him expect him to watch it while you went and did something. So he and I became quite active in things. I love my story. In 2020, when most of the world was shut down, we went and visited every Iowa State Park for their 100th anniversary. So we kept very busy and did a lot of great things and created a lot of memories. We did not stop traveling until last December. And I knew that one trip we took was going to be our last, because it just became too tough.
Wow.
To take him out and have him stay in hotels and be ready when we needed to be someplace. So, but we traveled a lot, and it kept us busy, because that's what kept me sane.
Yeah. And you mentioned the support groups that you've been part of.
What? Correct.
These have felt essential for you. What is it that you get from these support groups?
There would just be another group of people that were going through similar situations, not exactly, but you could just talk about it. You could share anything and everything. And I often say we laugh more than we cried, because you had to look at things with a good sense of humor. The strange behaviors that would take place. And so it just has become an extremely close group of people, extremely tight bonds that you create with these people. And they're your support, more than you can even imagine, unless you go to one of them. But I live for those 2 times a week to go and chat with these people.
You talked about how you needed to be with your husband all the time. He needed to be with you. As things progressed, how did you get a break, or could you get a break? How did you reach out for any kind of respite care?
I tried to put him in a day program. It did not work out for him for a number of reasons. The program was fine, but it just was not a good fit for him. So therefore, there were a couple of times a month. One was actually once a week, where I would bring home care into our home, and they would essentially stay with him. Until the last few months, he did not need assistance. He just needed someone to be with him so that he wouldn't wander away, wouldn't do anything harmful when I wasn't there. So I would bring people into the home for a few hours at a time.
Did you get help making that happen? I mean, we've been talking about the resources available to caregivers. Is that something that you could get assistance with?
Yes, there are a number of agencies that in the Cedar Falls, Waterloo area that have in-care home assistance. So that was not an issue at all to find that. The place to take him out and give me some respite in my own home, where I could be by myself, is virtually non-existent in the community I live. Mm. So I'm pushing for that type of a facility to take place here in the community. So I'm working on that with a couple other individuals. So hopefully others can benefit from that.
And
get some time to themselves.
Yeah, your husband finally needed to move into a facility. Tell me why you felt like it was time.
People say you'll know when it's right. That was actually mentioned earlier. It was when he started to become more combative, when I would ask him to do things, when I would ask him to take off an extra pair of clothing because he would like to layer things. And
pairs of pants, multiple socks,
correct.
Multiple shirts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. Those type of things. You can let that go some of the time, but there are often times when, you know, you really, if you're going out in public, you really only do need one pair of pants on. So he got to be combative, and verbally combative, and just, no, I'm not going to do that. You can't make me do that. And so that was just hard. And I'd been living with it for so long, I just knew I was at my breaking point.
And now I'm sure that there's an adjustment in this period as well. We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you, what are some of the pieces of support or the tools that you've been able to use that have really made a difference in your life? I know one of them that you've mentioned is access to family restrooms.
Oh, that is a huge thing. You never really think about it until you need it. And I applaud the agencies and the restaurants and the stores that have family bathrooms, because it's so needed, especially when you get to that point where you have to be with them and make sure that they're, you know, doing things, toileting properly and that sort of thing. So family bathrooms and the day respite areas are the key things, and support groups.
You also struggled with your husband's driving because he didn't understand that he really couldn't drive safely by himself. He could drive okay, physically drive, but he couldn't find his way home and other problems like that. You felt like you didn't get enough support with that. Tell me more about that.
He got lost on a number of occasions, would take the car out, and then I had no idea where he was at. The phone tracker, when he would take his phone, would help me find him, which was wonderful. But I did not have issues, but there's a lot of individuals I've talked to at support groups that feel like the agencies are not acknowledging the fact that if someone goes in and you ask them, if you go into the DOT and you ask them what day it is and it, or what season it is, and it's summer and they say winter, and you know, different things that, you know, maybe they're not fully cognizant of driving, and it's not so much the driving as it is the not knowing where they're going. It seemed like he had the capacity to always tell me when a stop sign was coming and that sort of thing, and that there was a car to the right or the left. He would tell me those sorts of things, but there was no way he could tell you how to get right to the grocery store.
And you felt like too much of the burden of taking away his keys was on your shoulders.
Correct. And many caregivers and loved ones and family members say the same thing. It's just, we need somebody else to tell them they can't drive. Otherwise, we're the bad guy taking away their car keys.
Jan Blevins, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us
today. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Jan Blevins lives in Cedar Falls, and she's been caring for her husband who has Alzheimer's. And Alicia Frady is still with me, caregiver specialist with Connections Area Agency on Aging. And Alicia, I'm sure that Jan's story sounds incredibly familiar to you. And she talked about accessing respite care. Can you tell me a little bit about the resources that are available for caregivers who need a break?
Yes. So through our area agency on aging with Connections, we are able to locate those agencies that are able to provide that respite for them, and, you know, walk alongside of them, making sure that they're able to find those resources, because it is difficult, especially when you're overwhelmed caring for them. And then on top of that, you're calling all these different agencies, trying to figure out who has availability when, you know, our case managers could help alleviate some of that.
There are so many Iowans who are caring for their spouse or their partner, and the caregiver themselves, they are also elderly and vulnerable. I mean, the amount of stress that a caregiver experiences, that can take a serious toll on their health. Tell me more about that.
Yes, I've read some studies that have shown that an average caregiver, their life expectancy will decrease 4 to 8 years just because of being a caregiver and the stress that it takes on them. You know, caregivers are constantly worrying about the person they're caring for. They have a lack of support, or they're hesitant of asking for help. They can be lonely because you're just focused on your loved one and taking time for them instead of reaching out to others.
What happens when a caregiver has a health crisis and they're the person caring for someone else who cannot take care of themselves?
A lot of times we'll hear from medical professionals calling in with that the caregiver is just very burnout and that they need some help. And that's where our agency would then call that caregiver and see what's going on and seeing how we can help alleviate some of that stress for them.
Alicia, stay with us. We need to take another short break. Alicia Frady is a caregiver specialist with Connections Area Agency on Aging. This hour, we're talking about caregivers. There are 330,000 unpaid caregivers in Iowa. That number is going to grow in the next couple of decades. If that describes you, call and share your experience or ask your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the work done by unpaid caregivers. According to a recent report from the AARP, there are 330,000 unpaid caregivers in Iowa, and that number is going to grow. With me still, Alicia Frady, caregiver specialist, Connections Area Agency on Aging, and she's sticking around to answer your questions. If you are a caregiver and you want to know how to get the resources you need, or if there are resources available, give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And also joining us now, Paige Yonce, State Advocacy Manager for the AARP. Hello, Paige.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. And I mentioned that number, 330,000 unpaid caregivers in Iowa, which sounds extraordinary. And it's even more extraordinary when you take a look at the work that you've been doing and see how quickly that number has been growing. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The number is staggering, right? The idea that there's only about 3.2 million Iowans, but 330,000 of them are caregivers. That's an astonishing number. And that totals about 310 million care hours every year, which is an economic value that we estimate of about $5.2 billion in unpaid care alone.
$5.2 billion. That's extraordinary.
It is. It is extraordinary. And, you know, as mentioned earlier, relating to census data, by 2034, there will be more individuals over the age of 65 than children under the age of 18. So the anticipated rate of caregivers is just going to skyrocket.
As we go through this transition, I mean, a lot of people are going to become caregivers who have no idea that they're going to become caregivers. What do we know about really our understanding of this role that so many of us take on?
Yeah. I mean, when I sit here and listen to all these conversations, Charity, I think to myself, there will be a time that I am a caregiver. I'm in my 20s right now, but I'm the generation who needs to care the most. Getting young people involved in the conversation about caregiving is absolutely crucial. And I think an important thing to note about caregiving is that you don't have to be a family member to be a caregiver. For some people, it's a friend or a neighbor, or really anybody who has a significant personal relationship. So I think about my group of friends. There may be a day where one of them really needs some help and their family or their friends can't provide, but maybe I can step in and do that. And I think that it's an important topic for everybody to just pause and consider.
Well, and just thinking about that, I mean, a lot of people lose their social circle as mm-hmm. they decline. But if you are a friend, if you're somebody just a little bit on the outside, just spending a couple of hours and giving a caregiver a break could be an yeah. incredible gift that you could share. I find it fascinating that a lot of people who are caregivers don't actually identify as caregivers. Yeah. So a lot of us are doing this and we don't even give ourselves credit for it.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. You know, when you think about being a caregiver, some people put it into the category of responsibility or duty. If I think about it as a daughter and specifically an only child, I feel that I have a daughter role to play in the care that I provide my parents someday. But interestingly enough, those people may not identify themselves as a caregiver. It might just be, well, I'm a daughter. I'm a friend. But you're absolutely right. They're not taking credit for all of the hard work that they're doing. If you listen to all the things that Jan and Elise shared, that's hard work. That is stuff that we would normally, quote unquote, outsource, right? We would have somebody else help us with it. But as a family member, we take that burden on ourselves a lot of times.
Well, and, you know, we talked earlier about Elise being a caregiver at a time in life where she also needs to be actively working yeah. as also a single mother. You mentioned the dollar amount that we could put on these hours that are invested by unpaid caregivers. Mm-hmm. But what about the economic toll? Because I can imagine that for a lot of caregivers, their ability to make a living is seriously impacted by this.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually a 2019 survey done that found that 19% of working caregivers had to leave their job at some point to care for a close family member or friend. So if we just pause and consider, if we've got people leaving the workforce at a 19% rate who has a caregiving responsibility, not only is that impacting the caregiver themselves and their income, but that's impacting a broader community and the broader economic impact of that. And the majority of people who are caregivers, like Elise, are working full or part-time jobs. And the cost of care doesn't decrease, and it certainly isn't going to decrease necessarily. We're living in a time of high inflation, and the amount of money it takes to provide care for somebody, it just continues to increase.
Well, I want to focus in a moment on some of the recommendations that, yeah. that you have with the AARP and some thoughts that also Alicia may have for things that we could be doing better to support caregivers. I also want to invite you to join the conversation. If you have questions or an experience to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Sue is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Sue.
Hi.
Thank you so much for calling. And you are a caregiver. Tell me a little bit about your situation.
I am. My husband is a stroke survivor. I am in my late 50s, so I am giving up my prime earning years. Speaking about the economic impact that you were just talking about, that's one of my greatest fears. We will use up all of our retirement savings in his care before he qualifies for any kind of assistance. We will use up everything. I am using up my opportunity to put money away for my retirement. So I foresee a future for myself of living in poverty through the rest of my years of my life. Because of our reserves, we don't qualify for any kind of respite care now. And in trying to conserve those funds, I have not had a single day off in over 6.5 years. The emotional toll that takes on a person just incredible.
I'm so sorry that you're going through this, and what a really incredibly difficult conversation. I'm so glad that you shared this with us, because this is a situation I'm sure you're not alone in, Sue, but it is such a difficult thing. And I mentioned, Jan, your hope for things we could do better in the future. Obviously, we are failing Sue. She is a full-time caregiver who is not receiving support because of the system that we have in place right now. Paige, what do you think we could be doing for caregivers in Sue's situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sue, you are absolutely not alone. And I hope that you know that. you know, you mentioned the financial aspect and the fact that you are giving up prime earning. And you're absolutely right. For a lot of people, it is a personal sacrifice, not only a family level sacrifice, but a personal sacrifice. You know, there are kind of three areas that you can really focus on supports for caregivers. One of them is education and increasing awareness. In shows like this charity, having conversations, community collaborations, that's the first step, right? Making sure people understand that we are failing our caregivers, that we need to increase the supports that we're providing them. That second step is expanding research and data and evidence-based practices through studies and surveys, like what AARP is doing, to really provide some numerical data to back up these anecdotal stories that we're hearing from people. But then the next level is increasing the ways we meet the gaps in care. So like we mentioned, respite care, both offsite and in-home, expanding access to that, especially in rural communities in Iowa. We have a lot of home and community-based service deserts in the state of Iowa, but yet we know that more than 85% of Iowans want to age in place in their own home. And not even for people aging. It could be someone with a long-term illness or a stroke survivor, like your husband, Sue. But the next step is financial supports, too. There are conversations on federal and state levels to say, hey, how can we provide a credit for caring? At the federal level, there is actually a bill that's sitting out there right now called the Credit for Caring Act. And Senator Joni Ernst is actually a huge proponent of this. And she indicates, you know, providing a federal tax credit for up to $5,000 for eligible caregivers could be a huge relief and provide some financial support to them.
That, of course, doesn't help Sue today.
No.
And I mean, listening to Sue's situation, $5,000 would be a help, but what she is losing through not being able to work right now is so much larger than that. Alicia, I would love to hear your thoughts. Sue is in a population that probably wouldn't think to call an area agency on aging. Is that somewhere she should reach out to?
Yes, that would be a great start. Her local area agency on aging could help with finding those resources or even asking if they have some funding available to help with respite care. You know, we see it a lot. A lot of families are in the same situation.
Are there, for people who don't qualify for funding, are there volunteer groups who offer respite care?
You know, it's very, or the lack of providers for respite care is very, it's very high right now. And it's one of the gaps that we've really, in Iowa, are struggling with.
What do you think Iowa could do to fill that gap?
If they could allow more funding to help the caregivers with either, you know, that financial need, and that they can hire somebody that they know to help with respite, or hire an agency that would be able to do that, where they're not spending so much out of their retirement to help with that.
And so, again, I mean, that's something that it would be nice to have in the future. That doesn't help Sue today. I mean, this is just an incredibly difficult situation. I would love to hear your thought, Paige. Do you feel like we are failing our caregivers?
Yes, I do. I think that we are reaching kind of that tipping point, not only just in Iowa, but across the country, to say there are so many people like Sue. And as we've mentioned, all of these solutions we're putting forward are futuristic, right? They are not in the now solutions to the issues that are very real to Sue and so many people. So yeah, Charity, I do. I think we are failing our caregivers right now.
We have an email from Jean in Davenport. He says, one of the biggest challenges in caregiving for 96-year-old parents is transportation. Are there affordable ways to transport seniors to doctor's appointments? Alicia, Jean lives in Davenport, and she does also mention that the CASI, the Center for Aging Seniors in Davenport, is a wonderful resource. But I don't know that she's in your area, but is that the kind of thing that an agency on aging can help with?
Yes, it is. They can find those resources for her.
Okay, and so transportation is something that you really can help connect people with.
Yes.
I also want to read this email. Daisy in Cedar Rapids writes that Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids opened a caregiver resource center. The Family Caregiver Center at Mercy is Eastern Iowa's only comprehensive resource for serving family caregivers caring for adults. So there are a growing number of organizations that are out there to support. Obviously, we have this growing need, so there are going to be more organizations that are trying to meet that need. Is that something that the AARP is also tracking, Paige, the growth in these services?
Yeah, absolutely. We are always looking for ways to uplift and support any of these new and emerging groups, and encourage those individuals to reach out to us and look for ways that we can have conversations. I think half the battle is just engaging in the right community partnerships.
I can imagine, though, you know, this hour I've talked with two people who are caregivers. Both of those people are native English speakers and people of education and who understand how to reach out for the resources that they need. There are going to be a lot of other people in caregiving situations who are going to have a much harder time accessing those resources. Tell me about more vulnerable people who are filling these caregiving roles.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we see in Iowa, right, a predominantly Caucasian population, but caregiving impacts those of a various backgrounds differently. More African-American and Hispanic Latino caregivers are involved in high intensity care with someone with greater needs. And Hispanic and Latino caregivers tend to be younger and often have more children under the age of 18 at home.
So again, that sandwich generation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you look at cultural influences on how families interact, right? The multi-generational home, that's very different across different cultures. And you're absolutely right that the English-speaking population is certainly where the bulk of those resources are targeted right now. But I know that AARP really has a goal to make sure that we are including all people from all walks of life in this conversation, because it does not impact just one specific type of person.
We only have about a minute left. And Alicia, I would love some advice from you, because I know that you have heard from caregivers in all kinds of different situations, and you have seen them reach a point where they feel somewhat desperate. So for people who hopefully are engaged in caregiving but not feeling desperate at this moment, what advice would you give them to help prepare for the years and months to come?
For sure. The earlier, the better that you know about what resources are out there for a caregiver, like preparing for more of the complex need or care needs of your loved one, or start future planning for your loved one, like planning needs. Can you afford home health care, or do you need assistance? You know, those types of applications that they take time in preparing, but also to get approved for those type assistance programs. Getting the training that you think you need as a caregiver, you know, joining a support group or taking a class on caregiving would help as well. You know, knowing what to look for as your loved one ages and the care gets greater in need. You know, knowing what assisted livings could be out there and knowing the safety concerns in your home as well, or their home.
So looking at the future, which is a hard thing for caregivers to do when they're meeting so many needs in the moment. But Alicia Frady, thank you so much for talking with me. Alicia Frady is a caregiver specialist with Connections Area Agency on Aging. Paige Yance is state advocacy manager for the AARP. We've been talking about unpaid caregiving this hour on Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbie.